The federal government has direct control over 650 million acres of the United States of America. Many of those government-controlled acres may be exploited by private interests, like ranchers, for private gain, like grazing cattle. As we speak, the federal government is operating with a $14 trillion debt, which equates to about $21.54 per acre. A recent rumor making the rounds concerning the federal government's acres and its debt leads us to ask, will the federal government sell China the right to exploit our public lands?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 735th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Firenze who are tuned in as we stream along the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with our own Miss Idaho, Nikki James, on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
Folks, our federal government may be poor in cash, but it is rich in land. In fact, the federal government has direct control over 650 million acres, which is about 30% of the nation's total territory. To date, private interests like ranchers have been allowed to exploit the public's acres for private gain, like the grazing of their cattle. But this right to exploit is now being challenged, especially by environmental groups like the Sierra Club. In fact, the Sierra Club says, and I quote, commercial grazing is not appropriate on federal public lands except where it is shown by science that some grazing is needed to achieve ecological objectives. Ranchers who hold federal grazing permits see a threat to their future in these challenges, and so the fight is on throughout the West. But now a rumor of another threat is spreading through the early morning coffee shops of the West, and that rumor leads us to ask, will the federal government sell China the right to exploit our public lands? Here today to help us wrangle up an answer to this and other questions, we have Bob Kinford, who is the author of Reduced Stress Cattle Handling and also who is a professional cowboy. Bob, welcome to the Food Chain.
Oh, thank you. As long as I don't have to be on the lower end of it.
Well, we're all at some place or another, right? That's the fun thing about it. So you're down there in Van Horn, Texas. My goodness, it's hot down there these days, right?
Oh, just a little bit. Haven't had much rain since September. We got our first rain since last September, this last week.
Oh, wow. So it's been a monumental drought. We understand that the cattle industry is really going through it in Texas.
They're going through it in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico with all the fires on top of the drought. Mm-hmm. Just hasn't helped at all.
Not a banner year, not one of those vintage years, right?
No.
Well, you are a professional cowboy. And what the heck, you know, we city people are professional cowboy. What exactly is it that you do? You do some ranch consulting and reduce.
Yeah, I do a little bit of ranch consulting. I've just kind of broken off and trying to go my own route here the last 2 years. Up until the last 2 years, I've worked on ranches from starting out in California through Nevada, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, and down here into Texas and Nebraska.
Wow. That is a cowboy, isn't it? Getting around then.
You know, it's kind of funny. It's one of these deals where a job ends, and the next job might be 500 or 1,000 miles away.
Right. So where's your favorite ranch?
My favorite ranch is probably at the corner of Glacier National Park in Canada.
Uh-huh. In Canada?
Canada. I've worked on a ranch that bordered Glacier National Park on the west side and then Canada on the north side.
Wow. That sounds pretty.
It was pretty. It could get pretty tough in the winter, but it was really neat country to work in, and people up there was on the Blackfoot Indian Reservation, right. And those were just a lot of fun to work with.
Right. Well, having been raised in Montana and having worked on Montana ranches, I got a sense of what you're talking about here. Now, what the heck is reduced stress cattle handling?
Well, reduced stress cattle handling is handling cattle in a way that you don't put any stress on them.
Uh-huh.
And people, you know, we do things the way that we're taught or the way that we think, you know, we're going to make that animal go do something. And, you know, it's a lot, in some respects, it's a lot like the natural horsemanship movement that's going around.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah, exactly.
Because the
horse whisperer, right?
Yeah, it's I'm a horse mumbler. I mumble to my horses to get them to whisper to the cows. Makes for more tender steak. But if you handle your cattle in certain ways, and the thing is all grazing animals basically have the same instincts. I worked with bison as well as with cattle. I worked for Leachman Cattle Company up out of Billings. One of the guys I worked with, we're riding around, and they'd have a few herds of antelope around there, and antelope would start running from us. So we decide, well, let's just for the heck of it, let's block them up, and we'd pick a coulee, and we're going to send them up that coulee. And we'd do it.
Huh.
Because they handle the same as cattle. You just have to be further away from them and be more direct in what you're doing than you are with cattle most of the time. But they will handle just almost exactly the same instincts and everything.
And for those who have not been around antelope, that's quite a feat to be able to herd them anywhere. They have a mind of their own, and they see a long way. And they inhabit country where they can see a long way as well. So to be able to maneuver them anywhere is pretty good. And what is it? What is it about the instincts of grazing animals that is the same? What are they?
Well, for one thing, if given a chance, they're going to run by you.
Right.
And if you use that as, you know, when you start taking and you start attacking an animal on the flank to move it or approaching it from behind to move it, you're actually kicking in a predator-prey type instinct.
Yeah.
And if you get out there and it's like, I'm one of these knotheads that when I was a kid, I'd sit out in the pasture and watch cows for hours and hours. And I'd watch goats and sheep. And you watch these cows when they're walking, if they're in the pasture or the pen, and you've got one that's more dominant, that's walking towards another one that's a little bit too close, that other cow will pick up and walk past it going the opposite direction.
Hmm.
And by using that, I mean, just using that one little thing right there, when you're taking and removing a large group of cattle, you can go ahead and approach them from the front, and they'll just spring out, and they'll go by you just like they're going to water.
Which is to say, walk peacefully.
Yeah, they're walking. Well, not necessarily walking peacefully. I mean, sometimes they'll go into, you know, you can see them going into water. They'll be running and bucking and playing. And,
all right.
I've got on my website, I've got a video where I moved 723 head. It was just my wife got down and took a picture of me taking them through one gate.
Wow.
And it was actually the second gate of a 3-mile, 6-gate move that I made by myself. And I turned them off the county road, and I went and I left. I mean, these cattle are going through that gate at a trot and a lope, and then you got to see them coming down the fence, and they're just walking along, and they get to where they make that turn on that gate. Boy, they kick up their heels and their button heads and running down. No stress on them at all.
Yeah. And thus, by doing that, you can save a lot of money and increase the weight of your cattle and well. Then you can make money. In other words, by being less stressful with critters.
Well, when the last place I worked at down here, before they went ahead and sold it was an irrigated stalker unit, and they sold it to some farmers. Well.
That's why
I left. They weren't going to run cattle, and it's like I'm not a farmer. It's two totally separate mindsets. And
Now this is something that is very interesting to me. Tell us the difference between the mindset of a farmer and the mindset of a rancher.
Well, if you're a cattleman, the cattle are your primary objective. You understand them more, and you can handle them easier. You get into the people that have got a farmer mindset, and the cattle are always on the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever you're going to do something with cattle, they just run in there and they go helter-skelter and just ram and jam as much as they can. You know, they figure the faster you're moving, the more you're getting done, which is usually just the opposite. In fact, when they first come out with the airbags on the pickups, there was a farmer, there was a neighbor of mine in Nebraska that he went to get his cows in and using a pickup, and cow didn't go in, and he goes and he bumps it with the airbag, with the pickup, sets off the airbag, cost him $750. He did that three times in less than 2 months before he figured out it wasn't a good idea to go chasing the cows with the pickup.
Okay, folks, we're going to have some fun today with Bob Kinford of Van Horn, Texas. We're going to be talking about ranching the public lands and what it's going to mean for our ranchers to have access to those lands, given what's going on in the world with the environmental community, with the government, with nature, and everything else. And you're invited to participate. If you want to talk to a real live cowboy, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We will be right back to Ride the Range with Bob Kinford.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back out there. You are tuned into the Food Chain Radio program. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today we're riding the range of West Texas with Bob Kinford, who is the author of Reduced Stress Cattle Handling and also a professional cowboy who consults ranches around the country, works on them as a cowboy, or at least was, and kind of settling down there in West Texas. Right, Bob?
I'm down. I do need to make one correction. I'm not the author of Reduced Stress Livestock Handling. Oh. I haven't written a book on it yet. I've got a lot of information on my website, on the cattle handling section at www.toolazyforyou.us. I do have some humor books and a cookbook on there.
Oh, okay.
Okay. It's not poetry either. It's actual stories. People get it confused. If you write a book, it has to be cowboy poetry, so...
Right, it's amazing, isn't it? You know, let's go back to an archetype of cowboys. You talk about cowboy poetry, but I'd like to go back to the whole notion of reduced stress cattle handling. And it seems to me like cowboys have always been specialists at reduced stress cattle handling, because it was almost necessary when you were, you know, on those long cattle drives of the early days.
That to me is interesting, because it's different in different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And the best way to really see the difference is if you start looking at the old Western art. And you go back from the 1400s, when they had the Spanish missionaries in California, and the way that they were handling their cattle, you see very little of running a cow to do anything. And their horses are bright. I mean, their horsemanship is just superb.
Right,
cattle handling is easy. And then when you get to the Texas end of it, boy, I mean, everything's done at a dead run. The horses' mouths are wide open and their heads are up in the air. And,
right.
You know, it's like a big rodeo.
Right.
And the differences on that was the fact that in California, when they had the cattle industry going there, they were mainly interested in the tallow.
Right.
Because they were selling the tallow for candles.
Mm-hmm. And then the meat wasn't worth much.
Well, the meat was a secondary deal. They'd salt it down and sell it to the ships so their sailors would have something to eat, and then they'd sell the hides. Because
right.
at that point in time, a lot of things were made out of leather.
I think this was told really well in Richard Henry Dana's 2 Years Before the Mast.
Yeah. It's been a long time since I've even thought of that book. But, yeah, yes, sir, that's exactly true.
Yeah.
Well, when you got down to Texas, they were selling that meat, or the cattle, by the head. And I mean, they were rough on them. They were more reduced stress as far as handling the big herds because they'd only have one person for every, 500 to 1,000 head of cows.
Right.
So they had to get them, broke to the trail and going pretty easy. Where today, it seems like you go on a lot of these ranches, and there's one out here that they work for that I cringe every time I go out there. But it's they've got 8 to 10 guys to work 150 to 250 head of cows at a time.
So that's pretty
they're having to rope something, and they have to rope at least one every time that they're going to the pens. And I sat down and I figured out the shrink, and that place, they're costing themselves $81,000 a year in unnecessary shrink just because of the way that they don't handle their cattle and then don't give the cattle a chance to do the right thing when they're going to the pens.
And then not to mention the excess manpower that it takes to do
that. Oh, yeah, the excess manpower. That last place I worked on, there were two of us there that worked the cattle, and we'd have up to 3,500 head. And at times, the guy I was working with, he'd have some place to go, and he'd be gone for a month, and I'd be stuck there with 3,500 head, and I'd move up to 1,100 of them at a time by myself.
Wow. Do you have a dog? Do you use a dog?
I had a dog I was using out there, but she's almost worthless. She's deaf.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't use her a lot, but I can use her. But once you get them in, I'd take to the pens. I'd take over 800 head of the cattle in across the road and put them in a set of pens and ship them out by myself.
Wow. What I was thinking with respect to reduced stress cattle handling was the singing cowboy and the tradition of the singing cowboy. Because it came from riding the herds, did it not? The notion of singing to the cattle at night?
That was probably not as much to keep them calm as to let them know where the rider was at, riding around in the dark.
Oh, right. Okay.
So
I know where the guy is at, so he's not going to startle me then.
Yeah. If you're just going around, you're just riding your horse around, and all of a sudden you stumble across where a cow is at, and that cow wakes up startled, but if they can hear your voice, they're going to know that you're approaching and not be.
Yeah, it's kind of like carrying a bell in the forest so you don't startle Mama Grizzly, right?
Oh, I don't know about that. go up to Bab and those Indians up there, they all call them dinner bells.
Dinner bells, huh?
Yeah, okay, because eventually they're going to figure out those bells that just mean there's something coming up the trail they can eat.
Okay. There you go. So I had an opportunity to spend an hour with probably one of the most liberal radio audiences in the United States and probably the most liberal community in the United States yesterday. And we're talking about my book, Metro Farm, and the whole notion of growing for profit in or near the city. And, of course, it startled them to think that people would actually grow things for profit. And I was discussing this whole notion of when you grow, the difference between gardening and farming, or gardening and ranching, one of them is something that you do for as a avocations for fun, but when you're in the business of doing something, you have to compete with everything, and not only do you have to compete with other people doing the same thing that you're doing, but you have to compete with nature, you have to compete with the community, and you have to compete with the government. It's just you're competing with everything, so it takes a lot of intelligence to do these things for as a business and do them for profit so that you can survive. And I guess that's what I wanted to talk about today, is I wanted to talk about the things that ranching has to go up against, one of which, of course, is the weather. And as we've seen in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico, it's been pretty damn tough to survive the weather. You also have the environmental community that is objecting to your use of the public lands. And now we have this whole rumor appears to be going around of how the government intends to take the public lands and turn them into reservations or something. So those are the three things I kind of wanted to pick up. And let's start with the environmental nature of things that or the climate, and that's one of the things that in ranching and in farming you always have to contend with is.
Well, that's true, and the thing about these environmental groups is the top leaders of the environmental groups, they are more concerned with money and power than they are actually doing anything about the environment. I mean, you look at Al Gore. Oh, he's all for the environment, but then he flies around in a private jet, you know.
A big much, one.
Yeah, yeah,
a
exactly.
Big one. Yeah.
And they want to go back to nature. But the thing is nature changes constantly. One of the big examples that, to me, that shows just how much nature changes, just how much the earth changes, is the fact that you can go from right on that Canadian border and probably up into Canada, and you can find clam shells and oyster shells in Montana, Wyoming. Well, I mean, I found them clear down here into Texas. Conch shells, Guadalupe Peak, which is the highest peak here in Texas, is actually a big coral reef.
Yeah, I remember as a Boy Scout in Montana hiking up on the very top of the Montana Rockies and finding a whole deposit of seashells.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a true eye-opener for a young kid, you know, to think, oh my goodness, this really is a living earth.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I would like to ask Bob Kinford the question, who really owns our public lands? Is it the federal government or is it the public? And what impact will that have on the public's right to use public lands? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our federal government has direct control over 650 million acres. To date, private interests like ranchers have been allowed to exploit the public's acres for private gain, like the grazing of cattle. But this right to exploit is now being challenged, especially by environmental groups. And so we pause to consider the question, who really owns the public lands? Is it the federal government or is it the public? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We'll ask Bob Kinford, the reduced stress cattle handler from Van Horn, Texas. What do you think, Bob?
None of the above.
None of the above. Good.
No,
enough.
Actually, it was set up in the Constitution. They gave Congress certain powers over land within states. And I'm going to read, this is straight from the Constitution, that they can, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over a district not exceeding 10 miles square, as may by cession of particular states in acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States, which that's Washington, D.C., and to exercise like authority, which in the language of that time, the word same did not exist, so it would be to exercise same authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings.
Mm.
So, Yosemite National Park, that should actually be Yosemite State Park. The National Forest should be State Forest. The BLM land should be state land. And what they did, even Washington, D.C., you know, you think of Washington, D.C., that it's owned by the federal government. But it isn't. They established in 1785 that they had to survey Washington, D.C. and then sell off the land of what they didn't need.
Sure. If you're not going to put a fort on it or a public building or whatever, you have
exactly.
to sell the land.
Well, exactly. And what happened? They actually adhered to that straight through till they got into Oklahoma. Then they went ahead and they decided, well, we're going to sell off. Yeah, I mean, you know, you have a territory, and any militia or anything, they would take and deed those people that fought in the militia, they would deed them land, and then when it went into statehood, it was state land.
Right.
Once they got into, you know, west of the Mississippi, okay, they started the Homestead Act, and you know, where it was $1.25 an acre, and people would go out and buy it, and then the federal government just kept what nobody wanted.
Right.
Well, when you get into the western part of the United States, they were only, you know, a quarter section, 160 acres. Well, when you look at the fact that some of this country out here takes 640 acres to run a single cow, you know, I mean, you might have a thousand cows go across that once, but then, you know, they've got to go someplace else.
Yeah, they have to graze at 35 miles an hour.
Yeah, 35 miles an hour. You know, you get that 6-inch rains where the raindrops are 6 inches apart. And they never took any of that into consideration. And other than the western states, the main western states that have got the most public land right now, there was no public land that fell outside of that forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings until 1906.
The year of the San Francisco earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
So then, holy smokes, what happened? Because what you're saying, the Constitution says, is that the federal government should own only those lands that it needs to build a fort on or to...
Well, it's the same thing. The government tells you something, what do? You don't think about it. You don't go back and you don't read the Constitution.
So somehow the government is now in control of nearly 30% of the nation's territory.
Mm-hmm. And some states, it's like Nevada.
Nevada, 89% or something.
Yeah, 89%, nearly 90% of the state.
Yeah. So, wow. There we are. So... But it now says it controls it. So it the federal government now owns it. Now, to date, the private interests like ranchers or miners and whatnot have had the right to exploit the public land.
Well, it's not the right. You have to take and fill out the lease papers. You have certain procedures that you have to follow.
Yeah, you got to get permits, right? Or
you have to get permits. And... the permits are filed. You know, this is a hard thing for the ranchers to go ahead and do anything about, mainly because you can't. Your congressman isn't going to have anything to do with it. You know, a senator has the same power as everybody else in the Senate, but when you get into Congress, you know, a lot of these states have only got 3 or 4 congressmen,
yeah,
or 2 congressmen,
like Montana.
Yeah, and then you go to California, and now the majority of Californians probably wouldn't, you know, they probably think, oh, no, we have to keep it, because they get into the mindset of what they're told by the environmentalists of what needs to be done with the land.
Because that's who city people are.
Well, yeah, and it's I like to kind of promote agriculture just because there's so many people that don't have a clue to where the food comes from.
Right.
And... these people, you get your information source from the Sierra Club, and they're trying to say go back to nature, and the thing is nature has changed, and you can't go back to what it was because, one, you don't have enough buffalo. You'd have to take and rip out all the fences and take out all the towns, you know, clear back to the Mississippi River and west of California, to give them room to do what they used to do. So,
and there are those who would like to see that happen.
Well, actually, I probably wouldn't mind it myself if I could be one of the ones staying in here.
Yeah, I'll take
but
one of those jobs.
It's illogical. You can't do it.
Uh-huh.
And so the next best thing to do is to try to mimic what nature used to do.
Which is have animals graze the land.
And I've got a friend that just did her master's thesis on grazing in West Texas. And it's like the buffalo would, you know, every 5 to 7 years, the buffalo would go through. In between the buffalo going through, you'd have vast herds of elk and then herds of deer and then herds of antelope. So there's always something About once a year, there was something going through and grazing it.
Yeah.
And these wildfires right now, I was listening to a deal on the radio the other day, and Al Gore was talking about, oh, how terrible the wildfires are. Well, the way they've managed it is they allow a little bit of grazing. They've cut out most of it, so you get a lot of underbrush growing up. And then for years, they've tried to fight every single, you know, they put out every single fire that goes through.
And there we are. We have a wildfire then.
Yeah.
Folks, this is a Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking ranching in the West with Bob Kinsford, who is a ranch hand, a ranch expert, works ranches all over the West. And today when we come back, we're going to take up that weird rumor about the government selling the right to exploit our lands to China. True? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, fasten your seatbelts out there and get ready for one crazy rumor. This from Bob Chapman's The International Forecaster newsletter, dated February 23, 2011. Sources at the United States Embassy in Beijing have just confirmed to me that the United States of America has tendered to China a written agreement which grants to the People's Republic of China an option to exercise eminent domain within the United States of America as collateral for China's continued purchase of U.S. Treasury notes and existing U.S. currency reserves. I can't believe it. And yet, I think I'm hearing a similar kind of rumor from Bob Kinsford. Bob, you talked about hearing some kind of similar rumor from the Farm Bureau.
Yeah, almost exactly the same. I first heard it from a Farm Bureau board member in New Mexico that I happen to know, that they are getting ready to sell off all 193 million acres that are owned by the United, or owned, quote unquote, by the United States Forest Service to China. Now, I've also gotten it from a Farm Bureau board member in California that what they're going to do is turn it all into a national monument, cut out grazing completely, but let China come over and harvest the timber.
Wow.
And what they need to do, this has got to be stopped. You're not going to stop it in Congress because, I mean, Congress is, they've got too many people in there fighting. They can't even figure out what to do with the budget. What I'm proposing that they need to do is they need to sue the United States government over their right to be controlling this land within the individual states that does not comply completely with Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution, which of course states that the only purposes that the federal government can own land within a state is forts, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. And the way I believe they need to fight this, because once again,
they would be every state.
Well, yeah, every state that's got a national park, every state that's got, you know, and that's, or a national monument, and that's basically east of the Mississippi, that's about all you have. You don't have any grazing lands, really, that are east of the Mississippi.
Right. It's all west of the Mississippi.
It's all west of the Mississippi. And the thing is, I actually have friends that are lawyers, and I ask them things about, you know, why do they make non-disclosure statements on the Internet so confusing and so long when all they have to do is say, if you use this material, we're going to sue you for copyright infringement. And it's, you know, four pages long.
Right.
And to a man, they tell me that they teach you that in law school.
To make it more confusing so that...
They want to make it more confusing.
Billable hours.
Exactly. Billable hours and the prospect of more business because somebody doesn't understand it.
Because nobody understands.
Exactly. So if you go in there and you take a lawyer and have them go in to fight this, they're going to go into this precedent, that precedent, but they don't have any real precedent to go to because the federal government keeps saying that they have the control of this land. And it started when, as soon as these western states went from territories to states and they didn't have the lands be owned by the state.
So what you're saying is that by the Constitution, the federal government does not control, have the right to control this land.
They don't have the right to control it, and they don't, it's in the Constitution, they don't have the right to give any domain to anybody from another country.
Do you think that this is really a reality? That do you think that the United States is selling the right to exploit the public's property to China?
Oh, I believe they're trying to do it. And even if they're not, think about the difference in the state of California. You look at all of the federal land that you have in the state of California, that you are receiving no tax benefits from. I mean, your state right. is in the red big time.
We're as broke as the federal government.
Yeah, you're as broke as the federal government. And, okay, Yosemite National Park, they supposedly lose money on every single national park there is. But when you stop and you think about it, one, they let everything go to nature. They've got a few trails to maintain. All of the concessions, including the campgrounds, the concessions, everything.
Yeah, how do you lose money on that, right?
Is they're not paying for that.
Yeah.
They get paid, and the people that are doing the concessions have to do all the repairs.
Yeah.
You can't be losing money.
Well,
you look at the timber sales. You look at the grazing permits. The whole thing, and California could be getting money off that. But the only way to do this, and do it successfully, in my humble, dumb cowboy opinion, is that the brief needs to be written by two professors. One professor needs to be an expert in the language, English language, of the time the Constitution was written, so that they can explain, you know, like is the same word as same. And then you also need to have a historian that knows all about the Constitution and about the attitudes of the founders of the country, because they did not want to have
a federal government.
They did not want a strong federal government.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back with Bob Kinford, we're going to go to the phones, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do you think it possible that our federal government would be selling the right to exploit our public lands to China? Do you think that's possible? We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson and Bob Kinsford and you right back. Welcome back to The Food Chain radio program. Michael Olson here with Bob Kinsford of Van Horn, Texas. So much to talk about, so little time to talk about it in. But Bob, we have some phone callers with you. Care to take a few?
Bring them on.
Bring them on. Okay, Teresa, you're up first.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm liking Bob's idea of suing the government. My friend John says that the wealthy elite are divided over raising the debt ceiling, because half of them want the game of musical chairs to continue because they're making out like bandits, and the other half want the fire sale to begin so that they can use that money to buy the real wealth, which is the land and the assets of the government.
Teresa, do you think that the federal government is going to be selling the right to exploit our public lands to China?
It looks inevitable to me. And not only the federal government, but also the state government. When I look at Santa Cruz County, what we actually own as a county are only hundreds of acres, but the state owns tens of thousands of acres, which are not accessible to us to use. So I think the question of who decides, who actually owns that land, and how can we decide how it's used and whether it can be leased, is a really critical one. I'm glad you brought it up.
Bob, what do you think? Thank you, Teresa.
This brings up a couple of things, but if there's a soundbite from the president this last week that I haven't heard anybody comment on, and in it he's telling them that, you know, either make a deal to raise the debt limit or we'll default. Either way, I'm ready for it. It sounds to me like he is planning on defaulting on purpose, because whether they raise the debt limit or not, there are ways around not having to default. But just by that comment right there, it just strikes me as he'd like to default.
Rolf, what do you have to say? Thank you for joining us on the Food Chain today.
Good morning. I want to say to both.
Are you on the speakerphone, Rolf?
Can you hear me?
Barely. Go ahead.
Let me see how we can improve this here. That's it. Better?
Yeah, go ahead. Really quickly,
okay.
Though.
Okay, very briefly. I take exception with a good intent by you and by Bob about China, et cetera. But let's keep in mind the word exploit is really anti-Chinese. I've done business in China, and Bob, you know me a little bit. I mean, we've done farming and ranching, and I'm certainly very closely involved in all this. I think we should get off the China bandwagon.
Fair enough.
That's one thing. The other one is I just want to come back home to the thing here, and that is, Bob, what is the essence, speaking of exploiting, the word I want to get away from, what are the fees from your perspective in terms of fairness charged to the rancher? We used to lease like 100,000 acres.
Okay, it's not the fees. The fees are fairly reasonable. What is unreasonable about the way this is set up right now is you get taxed on your improvements. You're leasing this. You don't own it. The government can kick you off of it at any time. You get taxed on it. You get taxed on your improvements like you own it, but then the government can kick you off of it at any time. And there was the case back in the 80s and 90s with Hague.
We're out of time. I'm so sorry. Folks, contact Bob at bobkinford.com and comment on this at metrofarm.com. Sorry for those I couldn't pick up on the phones. Thank you, Bob, for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.